Hi, this is Circe Olson-Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. I'm speaking with Mike Hart, a veteran and owner of Coyote Camp Fire Lane Chow. We're speaking today via phone to learn more about Mike, the Coyote Camp Company, and some of the interesting projects that Mike's involved with. Welcome, Mike. Hi.
Hi.
So let's just start right off. Let's start off with your military career. What branch were you in, and when did you serve, and what was your MOS, et cetera, et cetera?
You betcha. Well, I started off my military service in 1977. So I joined the Air Force and served from 77 to 81. And my MOS, I was a fire protection specialist. I joined to be a firefighter, and I was very fortunate to be able to do that, serve my full tour as a fire protection specialist.
Very cool, very cool. On your website, it does say you have 40 years of firefighting experience, and so one of my questions was going to be, you know, are you a firefighter? But let's get back to your military career a little bit. So you went into the military to become a firefighter. What were some of the big lessons that you learned from the military that you carried into your civilian life once you got out?
Great question. You know, in thinking about that, Circe, the things that I pull away from that that military tour was really just the importance of discipline and follow through. Mm-hmm. You know, as a firefighter, you've got to have both the ability to demonstrate discipline under pressure, and then of course follow through on all of the work that's required. I, thinking of it further, was always amazed that as an 18 to 20 year old young man, that my peers and I, we were given so much responsibility. Mm-hmm. For the lives of other people and the equipment that we handled, and that taught me to take it seriously. You know, what we're doing is important, and every bit as important as what the current enlisted members are doing today when they're fulfilling their military service.
So I have a quick question. You said you joined the Air Force to become a firefighter. Did you walk into the recruiter's office and say that, or once you were in the Air Force, did they offer you choices and you picked it?
Well, a great question. Back when I enlisted, they had what was called the delayed entry program. Mm-hmm. And so I enlisted in my senior year of high school. Mm-hmm. And was scheduled to go to, and I signed up to be, they had the delayed enlistment and a guaranteed job program. Mm-hmm. And so I enlisted in my senior year and signed up to be a firefighter. The odd thing about that story is, mm-hmm, that back then the Air Force had a weight requirement, a minimum weight requirement of 140 pounds. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at 18, runner, calisthenics, etc. Mm-hmm. I when it came time to report for basic training, I weighed in at 138 pounds. And the Air Force at the time said, sorry.
Wow.
not acceptable. And they gave me the option to go in under an open enlistment, wherein I would just go and report to basic training and do take whatever job was made available to me that fit into my, what do they call it, the skill sets, that,
right,
the
right.
aptitudes. And so I agreed to that and completed my basic training and was then put into what was called casual duty. Mm-hmm. At Lackland Air Force Base while awaiting my military occupational specialty assignment. Mm-hmm. And one day I walked into the building where all of that assignment stuff happens, and I just walked up to somebody and said, I'm kind of looking for a job. And the guy said, sure. And he said, what do you want to be today, a cook, a cop, or a fireman? And so I said, I'll be a fireman. And I got my orders that day. And so that's how I made my way back into my chosen career field. It was just a happenstance walk into the building at Lackland where those assignments were being generated, and talked with the right person who
made
the right entry and gave me my fire protection specialist assignment.
I guess it was meant to be. You were
that's
destined.
Pretty awesome. Seriously, just that it happened that way, I to this day feel so very fortunate, because that's what I wanted to do all along. And so indeed a bit of good fortune.
So with 40 years in the field, you must have some experiences that especially stand out, although who can top your first story here, but you must have some experiences that stand out. Could you share one or two with our listeners?
Sure. You know, that's a tough one. I mean, not a tough one, because over the course of 4+ decades, you know, you accumulate a lot of calls, and and some of them are amazing. You know, the structure fires, the aircraft fires, because my first fire department assignment in the military was as an airport rescue firefighter, an ARF firefighter, as they're called, and of course that's another layer of firefighting. So, yeah, we've had, you know, the whole decades, they bring structure fires, the aircraft fires, and then of course I did the wildland firefighting thing for quite a while in Colorado. But I guess if you asked me to sort of call out experiences, I guess one that has come to mind more than once over the years was a call that I took, a motor vehicle accident, single vehicle, multi-rollover event, and it was one of those things where, you know, I responded with my crew, and a person, a mother and her child, hit a patch of wet road surface and hydroplaned, and sort of did an end over on their vehicle. And I had just noted at the time when we got them out that their vehicle did exactly what it was supposed to do. You know, nowadays vehicles have what are called crumple zones.
Right, right.
And so, you know, in order to absorb the kinetic impact of an accident, certain parts of the vehicle are designed to crumple. And this little Ford Taurus did that, and this mother and child walked away from what was a car, but was reduced to just a really compacted pile of metal, all except the passenger compartment. And so when we got those two out of their vehicle, we were all just amazed that, wow, they walked away from that one clean and without injury. And so but when you see that kind of thing, you think, my gosh, how is that possible? That when you look at the damage, just the mechanism of the damage, and to see that a mother and child walk away without a scratch, it's pretty impressive. And those kinds of calls stick with me. There was another call that we took. A 2.5-year-old child had the call came in as a 2.5-year-old child with an accidental hanging. this young child got drapery cord wrapped around their neck.
Oh yeah.
And it just so happened that the area was in a blizzard. And you know, visibility was nil, and snow was falling pretty hard. Road drifts were 2 to 3 feet deep, but we still had to make our way to this residence. And so we did. And you know, we got to the child in time enough, unwrapped the cord, and you know, brought him back, and he started breathing on his own. And you know, we wrapped him up in what's called a Kendrick extrication device, which just doubles as a sort of infant or toddler body splint device. And got him again in this blizzard weather to a waiting ambulance that also had to make its way through incredible snow drifts and low visibility to get the child to the hospital. But fortunately, the child lived to tell the story, and so did the rest of their family. So I thought about those calls, and those were pretty cool calls. You know, that they stick with you. Another good one, and this is a fun story. We got to I was on my ARF department, my airport fire department, and we got a call for a plane crash and single engine aircraft, and the plane had come in and crash landed. And so we get out to the runway where the crash occurred, and the pilot had self-extricated, so he managed just to do a controlled crash.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing he said to us after we got to him was, as we were helping him out, and you have to go through safety in the aircraft, you know, disconnect mm-hmm. the battery, mm-hmm. Shut off the fuel supply, that kind of thing. And the mm-hmm. guy said, the pilot, he said, you know, he said, after the second crash, I learned to pack, to stow soft luggage behind my head, because his first two crashes, he had hard luggage. And the hard luggage came forward and whacked him in the head when he landed. So we all just had a good laugh at that, because this was his third crash.
Yeah.
But he had learned to use soft luggage when he took his air flights. And we all thought that was pretty funny.
Whoa.
At the time. And once again, he lived to tell the story.
Well, I don't know. I think after my first crash, I might not be wanting to...
Well, we thought it was pretty good. The guy was a pretty friendly pilot, and we all got a kick out of that story. That's one of those things where, again, it stays with you, but in a real good way.
Yeah, no doubt. Hey, just I'm going to go off on a tangent, because I'm just like a, you know, shiny kind of person. You know, you always see comics of firefighters being called to get cats out of trees. I was wondering, have you actually ever gotten a cat out of a tree, and why did they...
Me, personally, seriously, no. I've been on those calls, cats in a tree, where the cat somehow manages to get down from the perch they were on. Been on dog calls where a dog went out on a frozen lake and the dog went through the ice, so we did a dog rescue for a dog on the ice. Been on a horse rescue where a horse and a rider got stuck in a super muddy irrigation ditch, and had to get this 1,400 pound horse out of the mud that was super deep and super sticky.
Mm-hmm.
Fire departments do respond to cats in trees, to dogs in trouble, to other animals as well. Absolutely. Part of the service.
That's interesting. That's really, we could go on all day about your stories. But let's talk about Coyote Camp. So why did you start Coyote Camp? What is it? And that's a great name, by the way. Is there something significant about...
So there is, and it's a fair question.
Okay.
I started Coyote Camp when I was on a wildland fire event in Colorado in 1996. So I was on a fire crew there for a decade, and we were out on a fire one day, and the food that was being provided for us was, you know, it wasn't that great. And I just thought to myself that I could do something better. And so I began the process of researching and experimenting and looking at what would be sort of optimal fireline food. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, Coyote Camp was born.
Mm-hmm.
The name Coyote Camp, it comes from this. When you're coyote camping, you're on a fire event, and you're far enough away from either your vehicle, your fire mm-hmm. apparatus, mm-hmm. or you're far enough away from an established fire camp that what you're doing is, if you're going off shift or if you're going to take a break, it's they call it spiking out. Mm-hmm. And coyote camping is when you are going to spike out in an area far away from your apparatus or the fire camp, and you step out of the burning zone where the fire is burning and into the black zone where the fire has already burned. And then you scratch away the burn surface to the bare mineral soil.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point and in that place, that's when you can take your break. That's when you can camp. That's when you can go to sleep. That's when you can take a nap. That's when you can have a meal and not be in danger of being burned over by an active fire.
Okay.
And so that's coyote camping. Just basically stepping into the black zone from the burn zone and scratching out a little place where you're safe to take a break, to have a meal, to take a nap, to do what you need to do to rejuvenate, to return to duty. In the wildland world, your operational shifts are 15 hours. And so, you know, you're working for 15 hours at a pop.
Wow.
And so you need to take a break now and again. Or, you know, if you've done your 15 hours and you're far enough away from camp, you need a few hours to sleep. And
right.
So that you just, you make your little coyote camp spot. That's the meaning behind coyote camp fireline chow.
Wow. So what kind of meals do you create? And are they your own products or brand names, or are they MREs or?
Good question. We produce all of our own products. We build everything we sell. Everything that we sell, Searcy, is product that you're going to be somewhat familiar with. So they're not military rations.
Mm-hmm.
Military rations are designed for combat environments.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, they have their own specifications and requirements. For us and for Coyote Camp and for the wildland firefighting world in general, the products that we produce really emphasize variety. I want you, if you are on the line, I want you to be able to have a product that, number one, you're familiar with, but also not have the same thing day after day.
Okay. Yeah.
And so everything that we produce, you know, we make our own products, but we're using off the shelf products. So, for example, most people are familiar with Hormel.
Right.
As a food product. Most people are also familiar with Oreos or Famous Amos, you know,
mm-hmm.
things like that. And so what we do is take those kinds of products that are, in essence, comfort food when you're way the heck out on the line,
mm-hmm.
and provide that to you in a meal pouch. So in a balanced caloric kind of way. So, you know, we try to maintain the minimum 1200 calorie meal, and sometimes that's enough, but sometimes firefighters need more because they burn a lot more
mm-hmm.
calories. So, but what we try to do is build a product that is calorically balanced, has fiber, has protein, has carbohydrates, has sugar, has electrolytes, has all of those things, and that
mm-hmm.
you're going to really enjoy eating.
Mm-hmm.
If you're from the military and you know that military rations, that they've gotten a lot better over the last few decades, but early on they were not the best, and
mm-hmm.
most people didn't fancy them too much.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal at Coyote Camp is to make a product that you like.
Mm-hmm.
And that you're going to be somewhat familiar with. So the products that we produce, they range from the most economic on up, you know, the variety is really important. So we make sure that we're using as many different components as we can to put a balanced meal together that will satisfy the appetite of a wildland fire crew.
So I know you provide meals, like you said, for the fire crews, but you do for other emergency workers too. And it's on your website, you know. Can just anybody order, like, if they're going to go camping, can they order stuff, or do you have to be part of an emergency response team?
Oh, absolutely. Seriously, anybody can order our products online,
okay.
No problem. The majority of our customers,
mm-hmm.
however, are wildland firefighters, but we do see orders come through from the National Park Service, from
mm-hmm.
state park forests, from police departments, from small city towns or town managers that want their crews to their, whether they're utility crews or other, to, you know, to have something in the event that they're out doing some kind of field work and
mm-hmm.
you know, and need some food. So we do see that, but absolutely, seriously, anybody can order our products. Our website, you know, www.coyotecamp.com for sure.
Okay.
You can hop on our website and see the range of offerings that we have. We offer products that are, you know, start at the most economic, cost effective, and range up through, as close to paleo as you can get and still be shelf stable, all the way to TSA friendly products that you can board an aircraft with, mm-hmm. and all of those kinds of options are important to mm-hmm. to be able to offer to the firefighting community, but as well for any recreationalists, outdoors mm-hmm. people, or anybody else.
Okay, so keeping on that train of thought, I heard you're providing meals for a rowing team. Can you tell me more about that?
You bet. In December, last December, we received an email from a group of veterans, and they're called the Far From Home. That's F-O-A-R from home. And they contacted us because mm-hmm. of the products that we produce, and they shared with us what they're doing. Far From Home is a rowing team that's going to be engaging in the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Rowing Challenge, which is a 3,000-mile rowing journey from the Canary Islands to Antigua Island, and we're looking for like support and meeting their nutritional needs. So they looked at our products and they contacted us. We sent them samples, and so they could do a tasting and determine whether or not our meal products would work for their rowing effort, mm-hmm. and determined that they would work. So we said absolutely. So we would love to find a way to support the Far From Home crew. Their mission in doing this row is to call attention to veteran suicide and veteran PTS.
Oh, cool. So are you donating the meals or selling them at cost to the team? Are you selling retail? How are you doing the meals?
Well, our goal, seriously, is to donate. We're a small company, however, and so what we're going to try to do is find ways to fully meet their field nutritional needs on a donation basis. And so if we can manage that, that's what we're going to do. And we're going to be seeking assistance from any of the supporting public. We're going to be seeking assistance underwriting the cost from other businesses, and basically trying to find ways in which the general public can engage in supporting this crew.
Well, it sounds like a great a great effort for you. So I wanted to know, how many days are you looking at? Like, how many days are they out there that you have to feed them?
It looks like the rowing team, it sounds like they're going to plan on about 55 days to do this 3,000-mile row. And so they're looking for quite a few meals. The row is in December, mm-hmm. and so that's what we're trying to do between now and the end of August is get them all of the meals that they need. They'll be burning through an average of 5,000 to 6,000 calories a day for the duration of the journey, which could take up to 55 days.
Wow.
So that's kind of what we're looking at, and it's quite an effort, but that's what we want to be able to do. We want to be able to fully support the field nutrition of this effort of theirs.
Okay, so I just had a thought. So I think I read somewhere or heard somewhere that everything that they are taking, they have to have on the boat, because if they get any contact with an outside person, who you're going to see in the ocean, I don't know, but if an outside boat comes near them, then they're disqualified. So you have to provide everything. And then, do you have enough variety? I mean, that's a lot of packs of food.
True enough, Circe. Indeed, everything that they carry, everything that they need has to be on their rowboat. And so, yes, we do have enough variety. variety. The meals that they determined would work best for them are, there's three lines that we offer that do work best for them, and all of them, even within each meal type, has ample, ample variety to satisfy a wide range of tastes.
Okay.
And I don't think there will be any issue with the meal selections that they have made. I don't think it's going to be too difficult to provide for them the level of diversity or meal type variety they're looking for.
Okay. And is it true that if they get near another boat or something, they get disqualified, or did I just dream that?
That's what we understand as well. In other words, if they, I think what that means to clarify is that if they seek assistance in their rowing effort from another boat, then they are disqualified from the race.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if I had dreamed that or read that or heard that. So 3,000 miles across the open ocean sounds absolutely terrifying to me, but it's exhilarating. I mean, after the fact, I would sit there and, you know, brag about how wonderful it was. The whole time I would be just, you know, what do you like about this challenge? I mean, why are you all in for this one and not something else?
Oh, that's a great question. Of course, I agree with you that on the part of this race being exhilarating, I think it's exciting. I think it's adventurous. I think that a remarkable means to call attention to veteran suicide and veteran PTS. I think the thing that got me to thinking about it, when you read the mission of Far From Home and what they're trying to accomplish and the work that they do outside of this rowing event. I as a veteran, I know people, I know veterans who have chosen to end their lives over the course of years, and Cindy and I, my wife, we talked about it and felt that this is something that we could get behind. I'm a veteran. Mm-hmm. I'm a veteran-owned business. Mm-hmm. We know that lots of veterans in the United States today are struggle with a lot of issues from their military service. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, what a great way to get behind an effort that is whose goal is to help veterans with PTS and to help veterans who have considered ending their lives or their friends and family. Again, I say this to you and your listeners. I'm going to bet that most people listening to your podcast know somebody who has taken their life, or know somebody who knows somebody who has taken their life, and they were military service members. It's a pretty tough issue. It's a hard issue to talk about.
Right. Well, and I would imagine that the firefighting community has quite a bit of PTS and suicide rates as well.
Would you say that one again?
I was going to say, I would imagine that the firefighting community also has its share of PTS and suicide because of all the trauma that the firefighters encounter.
You know, that that's true. Firefighters and law enforcement also are part of the same, at risk for PTS. There's no question of that, Circe, and and indeed, that's true. You know, I think every firefighter, I think every law enforcement officer, somewhere along the way in their career, has experienced PTS.
Right.
You know, I have. Lots of people I know have, and you know what it's like. And when I started my career in the fire service back in the 70s, there really wasn't any conversation about what post-traumatic stress was, you just dealt with it, and moved on, but it has taken different form the last few decades, and of course with returning veterans coming back from Middle Eastern regions of conflict, they're coming back with some really hard stories,
yeah.
And I think Sure, firefighters and law enforcement are just as prone to PTS and suicide as military members. But these are the people that reached out to us, and just reading their mission. And once again, as a veteran who supports other veterans, it just seemed like, well, we should be trying to do this.
So how can people get involved with Coyote Camp's sponsorship of the meals? So if somebody says, oh, this sounds like something I'd like to do, how can they reach out to help you? Because I think what you're wanting or needing is somebody to buy meals, right? And then you're going to donate them.
Yeah. What we're going to be doing in the next week or two, seriously, is we're going to be putting up a Far From Home link on our website. Again, www.coyotecamp.com, wherein folks who would like to support the Far From Home effort can purchase directly meals that will ship straight to the Far From Home crew. Right. And in essence, for people who would like to do that, what we will be offering is a BOGO, buy one, get one opportunity. So if you say, you know, Mike, I'd like to buy enough food for a day for this rowing team, and you do that, then we will match that, and we will make sure that another full day of sustenance is provided for this rowing team. So what we are trying to do is engage any individuals or small businesses who would like to be part of this effort.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll put your website in the notes under our podcast so that people can just click on the link and go to it.
Yep.
So I wanted to move on to another initiative that you're involved in, and that's the Griffin Heart Foundation. So you and your wife, Cindy, started the foundation, which is dedicated to civil conversations. It's about issues that divide us and are often very contentious and difficult. And so, you know, why is it important to you, you know, you're a veteran and a firefighter, to be involved in an organization which promotes conversations, research, scholarship around questions of fairness and equity, respect, identity, you know, and the complex ways that we interact with each other? It seems that, you know, this is very different than what you would be used to on the fire line.
You know, I'd have to agree with all of that, Circe. Being on a fire line or responding as a firefighter, it's a whole different ball game. But I think the thing that Cindy and I see in ourselves and in the world around us and in the world that we interact in, I think that the need for balanced conversation that encompasses more than one perspective is pretty important, probably more important today than it has been in a long time. You know, everybody's fairly well aware that there is so much a polarizing dialogue at play today that I think, in effect, I think we need some to promote some kind of modeling or mentoring or even promoting mentorships that help people overcome the polarizing conversations that prevail in not only in the workplace but in public discourse. I think everybody has seen in the last decade that the kind of discourse happening, whether it be in our workplace, in our personal lives, in our public discourse, it's just become so polarized, and people, a lot of people don't know how to have a conversation any other way. I think that Cindy and I feel that it's probably important to try to find ways in which and to promote other organizations or studies or a group of individuals who are trying to change the dialogue, who are trying to make it more encompassing, more civil. You know, there really isn't a good reason why we all have to be so polarized in our dialogue. There's really more to be gained by having multiple points of view, you know, to consider in any kind of situation or issue. And so, rather than promoting the my way or the highway, kind of dialogue that seems fairly common today. What we're trying to say is, let's find ways that we can support other organizations or other individuals who are trying to promote the ideas of equity and respect, mm-hmm. identity, and the complexities of human interaction.
Mm. Well, and you mentioned mentoring and mentorship, and I think on the Griffin Hart website, you guys were asking for guest bloggers, and you know, you were supporting other organizations, including ours. But getting back to the concept of mentoring or modeling good behavior, did you have good mentors as you came up the ranks in either the military or fire service? Like, who were they? What kind of people were they? And what stuck with you over these years?
Yes, I have, Circe, and I'm really happy to answer that question. You don't think about these things as the years go by very often, but indeed, when I was after I did my military service, I got out and went straight to college, and one of the reasons I was able to do that is because I enlisted under the old GI Bill back in that day. And so my college was paid for, mm-hmm. Through the GI Bill. I joined the local volunteer fire department in my college town, and so that I could continue in the fire service. And part of my motivation for that, even then, was to realize that Uncle Sam invested a fair chunk of change in training me up to be a fire protection specialist and a firefighter. So I just felt that when I got out of the service that I could and I should keep doing that, mm-hmm. Just mm-hmm. again, return on investment sort of thing.
Right.
So anyway, I joined the volunteer fire department in my college town and of Arcata, California. And I think that the two people that were probably best mentors, stick with me over the years, were two men named Archie Bernardi and Frank Toasty. And both of them were longtime career firefighters their whole life long, oddly or funnily, just as I have become. You know, mm-hmm. Archie was the kind of fella. When I was serving there, he was then probably the age I am now, mm-hmm. Which is to say in my 60s. Mm-hmm. And Frank Toasty was probably just a little bit younger than Archie. Mm-hmm. But the thing that stuck with me about those two fellas is that they were the consummate professionals. They were professional firefighters and responders to their core. They were level-headed. They were even keel on any manner of calls you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And just as important, they were never boastful. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just normal fellas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on a call, on scene, they're people that you just want to have your back. Mm-hmm. And I've always, over the decades that have followed, appreciated their even keel take on anything and everything related to the fire service. So they're people who were, how should I say, they informed the balance of my career and how I go about my own behavior on emergency events.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you're probably, now that you're a career firefighter as well, 40 years, you're probably mentoring people, whether or not you know it or it's not a formal
yeah.
or informal. You're setting the standard, and you know, younger firefighters are learning from you. You know, it's that institutional knowledge. And I wanted to ask really quickly, I know we need to wrap this up, but I wanted to ask quickly, has firefighting changed a lot in the last?
Oh, yeah, it has, Circe, and indeed, yes. While I've retired from my career fire service, you know, and wherein it was my livelihood, you know, for all those years, the area where Cindy and I live nowadays in Washington, the local fire department needs EMTs,
mm-hmm.
and so we moved here a few years ago, and I had just retired from my career department, and you know, they said, hey, we're looking for EMTs. And so Cindy and I talked about it and said, heck yeah, I'll be an EMT on the department here as a volunteer. And you know, the EMT thing is just, it's totally awesome. It's actually a wonderful thing. I've been an EMT for, 20 some odd years, mm-hmm. because when I first joined the fire service in the 70s, EMT wasn't an essential qualification, but over the years it has become that, mm-hmm. one way in which the fire service has changed. Mm-hmm. So I'm volunteering as a medic EMT here in my current fire protection district, and what a treat that is. I just so enjoy the patient contact. I so enjoy the ability to maintain my skill sets in emergency medicine. So that's what I get to do as a retired firefighter, and what a privilege to be able to do that. The fire service has changed a lot over the years in some ways. In some ways not. The mission hasn't changed, right? Mm-hmm. The mission is still to save lives, protect property, do all of those things, but the ways in which those missions are accomplished has changed a lot. Of course, you know, nowadays it's all so much of the how do you say it, the back-end work in the fire service, it's all digital, mm-hmm. it's computerized. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so even on a call nowadays, responders have computers with them to log in important information, to notify a medical authority that there's a patient inbound for them at the hospital, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. Culturally, gosh, how can I say the fire service has changed culturally over the decades? I suspect that is true. When I first joined in the 70s, women really didn't have much of a role in the fire service. Mm-hmm. Not at all. It was a man's world. Mm-hmm. But over the years, women have made inroads into mm-hmm. the fire service, and you know, to somebody like me, that's a delight. I've been on some awesome calls with awesome ladies, women, mm-hmm. and gosh, you know, they perform just as well as any man does on any number of calls, mm-hmm. and so I think that's changed. Women today can enter the fire service, whereas back in the 70s, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we definitely need to wrap this up, but before we do, I wanted to ask you if you have anything else you want our listeners to know.
Yes, just to double back to our effort with the Far From Home crew for mm-hmm. your listeners, mm-hmm. Please take a look at the Far From Home website to get a better sense of Far From Home's roots mm-hmm. and their mission, to see what they're doing and why they're doing it. Also, take a look at anybody at the Talisker Atlantic Challenge website for a history of the race. It's pretty cool. And if people are really interested, you can check out video footage on YouTube of a previous Talisker Whiskey Challenges, really just to see the kind of open water rowing craft that they use. I had never seen one before, but wow, pretty interesting looking boats. And but you can also on the YouTube see some of the amazing footage of the open water effort these crews make. And I guess I just can't fail to be impressed by the amount of stamina that it takes to do something like that.
Yeah, so
that's what I would say in closing, Siri, just to double back and for your listeners to show support for the Far From Home crew. And you know, we're going to be hoping to put the Far From Home link on our website soon,
right,
in the next week or two, so that anybody wishing to engage in direct nutritional support for this team can do so and show support for them in that way.
Well, so I just wanted to clarify. So Talisker Whiskey Challenge?
Yes.
Spell it?
The Talisker Atlantic Whiskey Challenge. So Talisker as in the whiskey.
Okay.
Scotch whiskey, that is.
Okay.
And So yes, the Talisker Atlantic Whiskey Challenge.
Okay.
What a race! What an effort it takes, and no small measure of stamina required to complete this this kind of race.
Yeah, no doubt. So Mike, I wanted to thank you for speaking with me today. It's been absolutely fascinating. It's been great. I will put links to the Coyote Camp, to the Four From Home, now the Talisker Atlantic Whiskey Challenge, and of course to the Griffin Heart Foundation in our notes under the recording so our listeners can see better.
Well, thanks. No, yeah. Thank you, Siri. My pleasure. And I'm grateful for your time and the opportunity to speak about this.
Well, we appreciate it too. It's been great fun. So I wanted to remind our listeners that the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brat Seal and Military Brats Registry. And I have been speaking with Mike Hart, owner of Coyote Camp. Ciao. And we will I'll get this up in the next couple of hours, but thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you much, Siri. Have a great day.
You too.